Transformation of America by Mark Phillips and Kathy O'Brien. Chapter 32, A Place to Run, No Need to Hide. Alex Houston had maintained his capacitor distributing business cover throughout the years, routinely changing company names and customers. By summer's end in 1987, Houston had stumbled onto a legitimate sales inquiry from the People's Republic of China. Unable to profitably manage a legal business, he looked on a partner whom he said checked out to have a curious but inconclusive association in U.S. intelligence. This partner was Mark Phillips. Houston had forbid me from meeting Mark until his background check was completed and his allegiances understood. As much as he was intrigued with Mark's past, Houston was enthralled with his propensity for conducting international business. In exchange for Mark's cooperation, Houston and he formed a legal corporation. Mark Phillips became president and CEO of Uniphase. It wasn't long thereafter that he won Houston's confidence through repeated professional successes, and Houston permitted me to meet him. I sensed right away that Mark was very different from the other men I encountered routinely. He treated me as though I were a person, and his eyes revealed no sexual interest in me at all. Instead of discussing world domination, slavery, pornography, drugs, and genocide like the other men I knew, he introduced me to the raccoons he had years ago rescued from certain death and then tamed. I was deeply impressed with how his wild pets loved and trusted him. I could not think to trust, ask for help, or even question at the time what it was that made Mark different. In the fall of 1987, Kelly was enrolled in Nashville, Tennessee's Sound Pious Catholic School. Her unusual behaviors were addressed in school counseling, but their causes and/or origins were never addressed. Kelly still laughs at the absurdity of being counseled to vent her anger by scribbling the source of her anger on a piece of paper and then jumping on it. With her anger being caused by extreme physical and psychological tortures and sexual abuse, it could not be so simplistically relieved. Houston had forbidden Kelly to display emotion, and had so conditioned her. Once, when he savagely beat her for laughing, I huddled in a corner holding her for hours. That did not positively affect her enormous nurturing needs any more than jumping on a piece of paper. With tears streaming down her face, she opened her bedroom curtains and cried out to what she believed was, "Bush's eye in the sky, why do you hate me? Why do you hate me so much, world, when I love you? I want to die now. I can't take it anymore." That, as evidenced by the near-death asthma attack she endured, further proved that Houston's tortures were too much for a 7-year-old child to coexist with. In retrospect, that remaining part of her mind that could question why her existence was too horrible to comprehend was locked away, and so it goes in the life of a mind-controlled slave. In December 1987, my 30th birthday launched the final countdown to my death. Houston was in regular contact with Michael Dante, as telephone receipts prove, and arrangements were finalized for Kelly and me to be transferred to California. There, I was supposed to be burned alive in a snuff pornography film and Kelly would become the property of Dante. But first, I had orders to conclude my part in Operation Greenbacks for Wetbacks by meeting with De La Madrid. Houston had booked a New Year's NCL cruise to Mexico for all three of us. Kelly and I were walking among the Mexican pyramid ruins in Tulum, when Houston pointed out an iguana lizard sunning itself on a rock near the parking lot. As Kelly and I approached the iguana, two Mexican secret servicemen emerged from a dark blue Mercedes. They used the keys, codes, and triggers to our programming that had been provided them to hypnotically create the illusion that the iguana was transforming into De La Madrid. This control technique was to build an amnesic block to ensure against memory recall. In reality, we were transported by automobile to De La Madrid's tacky museum-style house nearby. There, Kelly and I were taken into his all-too-familiar bedroom by a uniformed matronly woman. De La Madrid's bed was a king-size waterbed set in a dark wood canopy frame. This time the bedspread was a plush black blood red, which De La Madrid pointed out to Kelly as he set her on the bed. It was my experience that De La Madrid's bed was in itself an NASA technology adventure. Mounted inside of the canopy was a movie screen where De La Madrid viewed porn videos and / NASA provided films. From his bed I saw replicas of the NASA Gold Star mulch screen monitors that were routinely used in experimental mind control conditioning. By filming the actual NASA mulch screen group monitors, the resultant video provided the illusion of seeing a gold star mulch screen when shown on a single screen such as was built into De La Madrid's bed canopy. For example, once when I was in his bed, the same light blue sky with moving clouds was depicted on the monitor screens that NASA had used to lock in my programming. Somewhere in time, De La Madrid showed on his canopy movie screen. He further enhanced the effect by having me hypnotically float/drift on his waterbed, which he had covered with a spread of similar light blue sky with clouds print. My previous NASA programming was easily accessed, somewhere in time, through this simple, but nevertheless complex visual triggering method. The pornography shown was of me from previous taping, alternating with a built-in video camera projecting our sex acts onto the screen as they occurred. This time De La Madrid said, "Let us end where we began," referring to my witnessing the rape of my daughter in Shasta. He ordered me to undress and recline against the headboard of his bed. At the foot of the bed, he began pulling Kelly's jeans off as he said, "You gave birth to her, just as you gave birth to the border agreement, and now your role is through on both counts. The tears she will shed as you burn cannot extinguish the flames of passion you have passed on to her. Your intense sexuality has been regenerated in her, and this hormonal experiment in genetics will successfully evolve for generations to come. Your role is complete. And thanks to my friends in Washington, NASA has perfected the formula and given birth to the technology of mirrored procreation using recreated bloodlines. The only detectable difference makes the blood run cold. Reptilian. See for yourself." De La Madrid gestured up toward the canopy screen, where the NASA-created video of my giving birth to the lizard was depicted. By this time, the NASA-provided designer drug for mind control, Tranquility, had been administered and was kicking in full force. My eyes were hypnotically fixed on the video as he began performing oral sex on my daughter. She, too, was rendered helplessly defenseless by the drug and quietly complied with his every demand. Using specific commands, De La Madrid ordered me to spread my legs and display the vaginal mutilation carving. He positioned himself over Kelly's face, smothering her with his penis while he performed oral sex on my carving. When at last we were returned to the NCL cruise ship, Kelly and I were vomiting sick from De La Madrid's abuse and the high-voltage trauma that followed. An unusually large shipment of cocaine and heroin had been loaded, which was transferred into the walls of our custom-built motorhome once we docked at Key Biscayne, Florida. Houston supposedly stayed aboard ship for the next week off his engagement, while I drove the motorhome full of drugs and my sick daughter to Houston's farm where we resided in Tennessee. By the time Houston returned to Tennessee from his NCL cruise, Ken Riley had already emptied the motorhome and dispersed the drugs as previously planned. The only business Houston had to attend was implementing the final phase of transferring Kelly and me to Dante and being updated on Mark Phillips' latest successes. Houston immediately began programming me to not take anything but Kelly's and my clothes when sent to Dante at the same time. Mark Phillips and I had reached a level of communication that was new to me. Although I had no conscious understanding of what he was saying, the truths he spoke resounded throughout the depths of my being. For instance, when he showed me his Back to the Future DeLorean sports car, he wisely cryptically stated, "Sometimes you have to know where you've been in order to know where you're going." Just before Kelly and I were to leave for California, Mark asked me to help him force Houston out of business by providing him with the files on suspected corporate criminal activity that Houston kept hidden at our house. Not only did I gladly do so, but somehow I was able to ask for help in return. I asked him to help Kelly and me get away from Houston before I was killed and Kelly was sentenced to a fate worse than death. Mark assured me that he would help. The day Houston intended for Kelly and me to be transferred to Dante, I felt a strange compulsion to telephone Mark and notify him. That morning, Houston drove to Mark's office believing he was going to meet with him later that day. But Mark had brought a team of movers to the house and rescued Kelly and me. He had brilliantly intercepted us as we were being passed to our intended destination. Mark even understood Kelly's and my need to rescue our farm pets from Houston's abuse. He not only found good homes for our livestock, but he had arranged for them to be loaded and transferred during our frantic rush to move out of Houston's house. Within 2 hours, Mark safely moved Kelly, me, our pets and livestock to freedom. Despite brilliant orchestration, pandemonium broke out when it was discovered that Kelly and I had been intercepted and detoured from our intended demise. "Wake up, sleeping beauty," Mark said as he gently roused me with a cup of fresh coffee. "Welcome to a new day." My eyes opened. I had never experienced such kindness before, and it seemed like a whole new world to me. Mark presented me with a beautiful watch, which he strapped on my wrist. Noting my wonder and surprise, he explained, "Now you will always know that I gave you the time of day." The time of day? No one had ever given me their time before. They only took mine. And I never wore a watch before. I did not even know what month or year it was, let alone the tune of day. I had no concept of time, which Mark explained I must always monitor from that moment on. "You say someone is trying to kill you. Why?" Mark asked. I could not think to answer. I was totally amnesic. All three of us were now in grave jeopardy, literally dodging bullets while I desperately sought the answers. How could I have requested help when I did not even know who or what I was running from? Somewhere inside were the answers, and I intended to uncover them all. Fast. Now there were three lives on the line. Mark understood that safety was tantamount to memory recovery. At the same time, none of us could be safe until I could recall who and what we were up against. Mark quickly sold everything he owned, including his DeLorean, retaining only basic necessities. He also sold the motorhome which had been awarded me in my divorce from Alex Houston. Using these funds, Mark took Kelly and me to the peaceful wilderness of Alaska. February 4, 1988 marked the beginning of life for Kelly and me, free from our mind-controlled existence. It also marked the beginning of a new kind of survival as we embarked on the most dangerous game of international proportions. Despite death threats and attempts, intimidation and cover-ups, we have survived these past 7 years by refusing to keep secrets, which is in itself another story. 1. As quickly as the accuracy of my deprogramming notes were corroborated and verified, abstracts of various experiences and identification of abusers were vastly disseminated. Those who read these abstracts over the years literally watched me gain peace of mind, reintegrate. Transformation of America. Transformation of America is the documented autobiography of a victim of government mind control. Kathy O'Brien is the only vocal and recovered survivor of the Central Intelligence Agency's MKUltra Project Monarch mind control operation. Chiseled deep into the white stone of the CIA's Langley, Virginia headquarters is a partial verse lifted from the Holy Bible and writings of St. John. "Ami, the truth shall make you free." This statement, like the agency, is total reality. The building that it is engraved upon houses the world's most successful manufacturer of lies to facilitate psychological warfare. The company uses truth and technology as their raw materials to produce pure lies for control of you and America's allies. Within the pages of Transformation of America, you'll find the truth. Us. Government 1001st Control. On August 3, 1977, the 95th U.S. Congress opened hearings into the reported abuses concerning the CIA's top-secret mind control research program codenamed MK-Ultra. On February 8, 1988, an MK-Ultra victim, Kathy Abnin, was covertly rescued from her mind control enslavement by intelligence insider Mark Phillips. Their 7-year pursuit of justice was stopped for reasons of national security. Transformation of America exposes the truth behind this criminal abuse of the unconstitutional 1947 National Security Act.